then, you see, people have been confused historically about all kinds of relatively elementary things. And it would be impossible to explain everything. But I would illustrate it by explaining what was traditionally called the integration ambiguity for open supergroups. That won't help you here very much. Okay. So, let's just consider a very naive case. In one even and two odd variables. I'm going to call them T, theta 1, and theta 2. But the only trick is that we want it to be a half line, a superversion of a half line. So, roughly, it's going to be t equal to or bigger than 0. But that needs to be specified accurately because, you see, well, we'll decide in a little bit what this means. But you might ask, why not do that? So, the answer is that part of what it means to describe a super manifold with boundary is that you have to give a coordinate with a simple zero on the boundary I'll call it t up to t going to e to the f t. So this and this have to be thought of as two different supermanifolds. But by contrast, that would be the same supermanifold because the left-hand side is the same as t times e to the something. Well, this function can be written as t times e to the f for some f. But t plus theta 1, theta 2 can't be written that way. So when we talk about a supermanifold with boundary, we have to be given a function that vanishes on that, has a simple zero on that boundary. So you see, the point is that e to the f is an invertible function. So if t has a simple zero, then intuitively, if t has a simple zero, then e to the f times t has a simple zero. So this supermanifold with boundary and this one are different, but this one is equivalent to this one. Now, okay. Well, why do we care about this? So M, we'll call this supermanifold here. Well, we'll decide in a moment which one. And then what people traditionally called the integration ambiguity was this. Well, I'm putting in just the fact e to the minus t squared factor to make sure it converges. We're only interested in the behavior near zero. And so, okay, that integral looks like it's zero, because if we integrate over the thetas, we get zero, and the t integral converges. But if we change variables, let's see what happens. We can actually erase the theta 1, theta 2 here. Right. Oh, okay. To explain that properly, we should have discussed Berezinians and how supermeasures transform under changes of coordinates. But if it were bosonic, you'd say that d theta 1 times d, you know, you don't want d theta 1 times d theta 1. So there was some explanation involved, but ultimately we can drop this theta 1, theta 2. But now this one in the exponent, we better not drop. And you see now if we do the theta 1, theta 2 integral, We get minus 2 times this interval, which is not 0. So this is what was described in the 80s by saying that some of the literature was a bit murky, but I think this is the best explanation of what was called an integration ambiguity. Now, there are worse problems in the interior of moduli space, but this is a problem that arises on the boundary. And actually, we basically heard about boundaries in the last lecture, because when we consider open strings, so I didn't plan this very well, but so the moduli space of open strings has boundaries. It even has corners where boundaries intersect. But it simply has boundaries because, you see, the modulus for a single open string is a real parameter, which I think was K in the last lecture. For a closed string, it would be a complex variable, often called Q. But for open strings, it's a real variable, K. Of course, K can go to infinity, but if you want to see the goings-on in infinity clearly, it's better to use 1 over K. So, okay. If you're going to invoke Stokes' theorem, you have to know what's happened. Over here, I presented this in terms of a supermanifold with boundary. Of course, we could have replaced T by 1 over T and called it K. The ambiguity wouldn't have gone away. Things are clearer if you talk about not going to one at infinity, but if you compactify, bringing your problems to a finite distance where you can see them. So we're going to work with T, which is 1 over K. And then, since K was a real variable, the moduli space of open world sheets is a manifold with boundary, and even with corners, if you worry about two different Ks going to both infinity. But let's just discuss one of them. The general treatment will be similar. So if we had a supermanifold with corners, we'd say the same thing. A corner means the two boundaries meet. Here there's a T up to e to the f times t, and here there's another function w up to e to the g times w. So at a corner, there'd be two local real variables. Real is the wrong word. Two local even variables that are each given up to an invertible function. But the essential idea comes from one. So, yes? Okay. So there's an integration ambiguity unless there's a distinguished parameter up to multiplication by an invertible function. But you see, I should have used it this morning, really. So in the Neuver-Schwarz case, there's no odd modulus associated to the tube. The propagation of the tube is just bosonic. The propagator is 1 over L naught, which is an integral, something like this. Okay, X is what I was calling T. So the only modulus that's involved in getting that is an even modulus. And this even parameter is uniquely determined up to e to the f times t, but not t going to t plus theta 1, theta 2, or a to 1, a to 2, where these are odd moduli. So, one could explain in terms of complex geometry the statement that there's a distinguished parameter. It has to do with the Deline-Mumford compactification of supermoduli space. But to be brief, I think we could skip it and just say that since we know that the propagator is just 1 over L naught, there's no odd modulus associated to that degeneration. There's only an even modulus. And that even modulus is what's needed to make sense of integration on a supermanifold with boundary. So that's the answer to one version of the integration ambiguity from the 80s. Yes?
So, in the approach I was discussing, this bosonic parameter is related to the propagator in the surface. And so it makes sense to define the boundary as saying that object is equal to 0.
Yes.
That's when the
two.
The problem is that the measure that we get also has poles in T.
Okay, we have.
So that's a kind of an extra complication.
No, that's an extra complication, and the answer is, you know, well though, which is that the poles disappear when you sum over spin structures.
Yeah.
And but the sum over spin structure doesn't make sense in the interior of moduli space, but the little bit of the sum over spin structure that you need for the GSO cancellation does make sense. That's because when a degenerate, see, I'm going to draw a different picture. Well, first of all, why does the sum over spin structures not make sense in the interior of moduli space? It's a ridiculously elementary point, but I had to explain it a lot of times, so I'll explain it right now. The definition of the odd moduli depends on the spin structure, because unfortunately we didn't have time to get that far, but the odd moduli take values in a vector space whose definition depends on the spin structure. So there's no notion of changing the spin structure while leaving fixed the odd moduli. So in general, it doesn't make any sense to sum a superstring amplitude over spin structures before doing bosonic integrations. Genus 2 is special because of a story described by Doker and Fung. So in general, we can't do a sum over spin structures, but the little bit we need for the GSO cancellation, we can do, because when this degeneration happens, spin structures are paired by the sign of a gluing. And so you can sum, it makes sense near the degeneration to sum over pairs of spin structures that differ only by the sign of the gluing across that degeneration. That is the sum, that partial sum that gives the GSO cancellation and eliminates the pole you were asking about.
So you expect this is true even if the like one loop dipole has this magnetic field switch? I mean, that object does not vanish.
It doesn't depend on any details. So the statement, well, I'm not certain which part you're asking about. So one part has nothing to do with the superconformal field theory you consider. It's just a fact about geometry that although the sum over spin structures doesn't make sense in general, the little bit that you need for the GSO cancellation does make sense.
I'm just asking whether the cancellation of the pole is related to some kind of cancellation of the one loop amplitude, like the vacuum amplitude is zero.
You actually gave a very beautiful explanation in your talk of a non-trivial example where you saw that the factorization mimicked field theory.
Yeah.
So if you just think about it in the context of what you explained, the same thing would have worked with the different field theory on the two sides. Okay. And regardless of what there is on the two sides, if you ask whether there's a tachyon running down the tube, well, if it's odd under the GSO projection, it will be killed by the partial sum over spin structures. That doesn't depend on the details of the conformal field theory you're working with.
No, but actually I'm worried about the U1 massless vector.
Well, I'm not sure what, Sorry, I thought you were worrying about the tachyon that was supposed to be eliminated.
No, that's...
I'm actually not sure why you worry about physical massless particles either, because they don't make divergent contributions.
Yeah, it's not divergent, but in principle could be finite contribution.
Well, I don't know what question you want to answer. Contributions due to massless fields are subtle in field theory, and they're also subtle in string theory. But what would you like me to tell you about it?
I mean, so what you're basically saying is that solution is exactly the same as in field theory.
Well,
study the field theory problem first, and then...
Well, when there is an infrared divergence in the field theory, it will be there in the string theory. But as you actually quite beautifully showed in your lecture, the behavior of the propagators running down the tubes when you parameterize things correctly is similar to a sum of field theory contributions. Right. So it will make sense when the corresponding field theory contributions make sense. I'm not sure what else I should tell you about it.
For Ramond?
Well, for Ramond, as you know, the propagator is G naught over L naught. Well, let's just remember, first of all, Dirac. Part of the story is the same. So there is still a real gluing parameter, which enables us to make sense of the supermanifold with boundary. But there's an extra ingredient, which is that there's also an odd modulus associated to a Ramon propagator. The reason is that the Klein-Gordon propagator is something like this, but the Dirac propagator is one of a D slash, which is D slash over a Laplacian. And that corresponds in string theory to G naught over L naught. And that is the integral from, I wish I'd planned this better. Beta is the odd modulus associated to the tube. And the reason the G naught comes in, well, why does the L naught come in? L naught extends the length of the tube in the bosonic direction. But the tube also has a fermionic length, and that's what the G naught does. So then when you integrate over the pair, you get the integral is G naught over L naught, which has the Dirac propagator as its field theory limit. Well, there's only one odd modulus, so there's a well-defined X. But the geometrical interpretation is interesting. The geometrical interpretation is the following. In bosonic string theory, so in bosonic or NS, well, that was like, in any case, so, actually, there are two statements. One statement is always true. Now, I'm going to go over to closed strings now and discuss the holomorphic case. It's a little bit more natural. So in any case, always the degeneration always means bosonic or NS or Ramon. Always the degeneration is a divisor D inside the moduli space. Meaning that there's always, in the real case, it's what I call X, in the closed surfaces with the complex parameter Q. But there's always a variable whose vanishing defines the degeneration. So that statement doesn't distinguish Ramon from the Verschwartz or bosonic. But there is a second statement that does. So bosonic or NS, D factorizes as a product of MG1 with some punctures times MG2 with some other punctures. For Ramon, that's wrong. You see, that's wrong because of the fermionic gluing parameter. The fermionic gluing parameter belongs to the divisor, but it doesn't belong to either this guy or this guy. So for the Ramon case, D is a fiber bundle over a product, MG1 times MG2. And the fiber is a copy of C01 parameterized by the gluing parameter. If you know that, you can count the number of dimensions of moduli. Let's just have a little bit of fun and calculate. We could do any genus, but we'll do genus 2 just because it's fast. We're going to count the number of moduli, supermoduli of a genus 2 surface. So we make it by gluing together two three-holed spheres, as in the last lecture. And there are two cases. Well, there could be NS guys going through each. This is meant, these. It could look like I've drawn an open string. It was actually meant to be a genus 2 world sheet. It's a little bit harder to draw. We could also do NS with two Ramons. So there are two different degenerations of the same thing, so they must have the same number of odd moduli. As I remarked at the end of the last lecture, actually, see, the counting of odd moduli is different in the two cases. In this case, the propagators have no moduli, but a genus zero surface with three inverse Schwartz punctures has one modulus. So there's one here, and zero here, here, or here. In this case, a three-holed sphere with one inverse Schwartz puncture and two Ramon punctures has no moduli, so there's zero here or here, but there's one here, here, or here. Zero here and one in the other two. So either way, there are two odd moduli. So you can try this in genus G, and you'll quickly see that no matter what degeneracy, so you build a genus tree surface by gluing together three-hulled spheres. And then you count the odd moduli that either belong to a three-hulled sphere in the case of three NSs, or to a propagator in the Ramon case. And you'll soon see that no matter what degeneration you consider, you always get 2g minus 2 odd moduli. There's actually something I really would like to tell you about for just a few minutes, if I could. So, so first of all, in the bosonic string, well, so something which was known in the 80s is that if one wants a conformally invariant formalism, the vertex operator, I'll state this just for either open strings or the holomorphic part of closed strings for brevity. The vertex operator O must be annihilated by B sub n for n equal to or greater than 0. So equivalently, it involves C, but not its derivatives. Or one more way to say it is that B times O has only a single pole. Simple pole. Because O contains C, but not its derivative, so there's a simple pole, not a higher order pole. If that isn't true, even if O is a conformal primary of the right ghost number, you still don't get a conformally invariant expression for the scattering amplitudes. And the reason you don't is that if you make a... you have to insert Beltrami differentials when you do your calculation. And you'd like to verify invariance under mu z bar z going to mu z bar z plus dz bar of fz, where fz equals 0 at the position of O. Because a diffeomorphism that doesn't leave fixed the operator insertion shouldn't be regarded as a symmetry. But there's supposed to be no other constraint on fz. So then when you make this substitution from u, you see you have dz bar fz times bzz, and you integrate by parts. And then you want to use the equation of Boshin for b. But the trouble is that it'll get a contribution from a pole where b meets the vertex operator. If the pole is a simple pole, you're OK because f vanishes at the position of the vertex operator. But with higher order poles, you're not OK. Now, there's actually a corollary, something that goes with this that is surprisingly little known, so I'm going to state it, which is that gauge invariance is supposed to be O going to O plus QW for some W. But to be able to discuss gauge invariance in a superconformal formalism, you need to know that W, that if O has only a simple pole with B, you can assume that W also only has a simple pole with B. And that's true. It can be proved by the method similar to the proof of the no-ghost theorem. And it even was essentially proved in an old paper by Charles Thorne, where he was discussing the no-ghost theorem. But I don't think it's very well known that this fact is true and that you really need it for gauge invariance in a conformal formalism. Now, this fact that you aren't allowed to use... So now we have two facts about O.
But isn't it true that dz bar b equals q of something?
It doesn't matter. What I've said... let me finish the story, and then we can ask questions. I'm a little bit worried about the time. I don't know. Okay. All kinds of things are true, and we can discuss them. But I explain what's needed to show that the choice of the Beltrami doesn't matter. If the choice of the Beltrami does matter, you can still calculate, for example, along the lines that Ashok described this morning, but the formalism becomes much more complicated. If the choice of the Beltrami doesn't matter, then you get a measure on moduli space, as most string theorists assume. If the choice of the Beltrami does matter, you need to use a more complicated formalism, even when there's no mass renormalization or any other funny business going on. Now let's discuss what operators there can be. So O is supposed to have ghost number 1. And it's also supposed to have no DC, D squared C, and so on. Well, that determines what O has to be. O has to be C times something made from matter only. Because once it involves C, it can't have any more C's without involving derivatives of C. And it can't have B without having the wrong ghost number. We can also write this as delta of C times V matter. Because a ghost is its own delta function. Sorry, a fermion is its own delta function. This explanation is more illuminating, I think. There's a certain sense in which the delta of C shouldn't be there, even though it traditionally is. C is an element of the Lie algebra of the symmetry group. That's where it came from. We gauge fixed the symmetry group. When there was a vertex operator, we should have defined the symmetry group to consist of diffeomorphisms that Lie fixed the position of the vertex operator. So the delta of C factor is just correcting the mistake we made when we used the same ghost that we would have used if there hadn't been a vertex operator. It would have been more natural to say that, I would say that more natural would be the following. O is V matter, but C is a section of T sigma tensor O of minus P, where P is the position of the vertex operator. It's equivalent. So when I go on to superstrings, I'll do it the traditional way, because people are less familiar with this. But I think that would have been more natural.
Natural symmetry of something with a semi-infinite tube.
Yes.
Goes to that.
Yes. Right. And you see, this shows you that the vertex operator is really made from matter only, because first there was matter when the world was created, and then, and then people quantized it and added the ghosts. Now let's discuss the superstring case. So we need the same thing. We need Bn and beta n, or beta r, let's say. Bno. And so B, I'll write B and beta for the antighosts, the fermionic and bosonic antighosts. And we need these to be 0 for n and r equal to or greater than 0, or else we'll run into the same kind of problem we had before. Mm-hmm. Now we can see what the vertex operator has to be. Okay, so. So in the inverse Schwarz sector, the vertex operator shifts the dimension by 1/1. So it must have ghost number 0 and picture number minus 1. Why ghost number 0? Well, actually, yesterday I think I called it fermion number or degree. What I explained is that to integrate on an n/n manifold, you need degree, you need a form of degree n minus n, and picture number minus n. In this case, when we add a vertex operator that increases the dimension of moduli space by 1/1, so n minus m is 0, so that's why the degree has to be 0, and the picture number has to be minus 1. And it also has to be annihilated by bn and beta r. So now you can see what the vertex operator is. So O equals C delta of gamma times V matter. Well, that's the only vertex operator you can make that has the right quantum numbers and the conditions I stated, of being annihilated by the B's and betas. So you could also write this as delta of C, delta of gamma, times V matter, or as delta 1/1 of the superfield C times V matter. So you might be, well, except that it happened 30 years ago, you might be alarmed at a quantum field operator like delta of gamma. But see, when, but actually, it's part of the picture-changing story that so delta of gamma is the way you describe in terms of gamma, the standard vertex operator of picture number minus one for the beta gamma system. So as I told you, the delta of C, delta of gamma, is really not there. It just corrects our mistake in the way we deformed the superconformal ghosts. We would have said that the vertex operator was simply V matter if we had defined the ghosts correctly as taking values in the Lie algebra of superconformal vector fields that vanish at the position of the operator insertion. So this funny stuff here just corrects for our mistake. Now, when we integrate over the, so what is a Beltrami? So, okay. I wrote a Beltrami as mu z, z bar beta zz, bzz. But it would have been better to call it this. And if you have a derivation that naturally leads to this, I don't really have time to do this now. I think it's done nicely in my paper, if I could say so. But there probably isn't time to explain it now. But the super analog of that is well, you have a super Beltrami. And there is a delta function of the super Beltrami just as there is a delta function of the ordinary Beltrami. So when you do the superstring path integral, you face what Friedan, Martinek, and Schenker ran into when they tried to do it 30 years ago. Well, that the beta-gamma system is subtle to understand, and in particular, there are delta of gamma and delta of beta insertions that you need to consider. So, we ran into something like that yesterday in the most elementary way when I was talking about what we meant by integration on a supermanifold anyway. We had to integrate over a bosonic parameter d theta, which was not real. I don't know if I should call it complex in the supermanifold, but we weren't super language, but we weren't allowed to call it real. And then we had to define algebraically that the integral of its nth derivative of the delta function was delta n0 times 1 over w. That was supposed to be a bosonic version of the Berezin integral. And it was part of defining what we meant by integration on supermanifolds. So we have to do the same thing in general for the superghosts. The superghosts are part of the same story. They integrate naturally with this theory of integration on supermanifolds. So, you see. Well, suppose there are no zero modes for us. I'm going to just tell you in sort of in a moment what integration over beta and gamma means. But first, we'll assume there are no zero modes, which would happen if they both had spin a half. Not the case we're actually interested in. So I'll be telling you about more general beta-gamma systems to begin with no zero modes. Well, we treat it as a bosonic Gaussian integral. It isn't one, because beta is complex and it's not the complex conjugate of gamma. There's no real structure under anywhere to be found. We just declare that this is 1 over the determinant of d bar. And I remind you that the same problem with fermions, we would have felt like more honest people. And now we would say that it's the determinant of d bar. So we know, though, that this is a formal definition. And this formal definition is useful for a certain class of integrals that we actually meet in quantum field theory. So this kind of one is useful for the same kind of integrals. So let's consider a more general Gaussian integral. So I'm going to add two more degrees of freedom. I want to calculate. What I really want to do now is to assume that there are zero modes. For instance, suppose beta have one zero mode. So this integral as it stands doesn't make any sense. So to make sense out of it, we need a delta function that removes the zero mode. I don't remember what I called it before. Maybe F. Well, okay. Now suppose the statistics were opposite and B had one zero mode. We'd know how to do this integral, but it would be zero. So we could remove the zero by putting in a delta function that removed it. However, I want to minimize the number of things we have to talk about. So I'm going to represent the delta function by adding one variable alpha. So I write what we want as the integral d alpha, and then the integral over b and c, and the exponential of what we had before, alpha times this fz bar theta times bz theta. Now we're just doing a Gaussian integral for fermions. It's just a bigger Gaussian than it was before, because the fermions are now B, C, and alpha. B and C are fields, and alpha is just one variable. And the matrix is sort of D bar, and something, F or something. Sorry. Okay. Well, sorry. I think I should do it differently. B has negative ghost number, and we should think of the pair C as alpha as having positive ghost number so that we can make sense of the term alpha B in the Lagrangian. And then I should write a matrix that relates positive ghost number, or negative ghost number B to positive ghost number C or alpha. And M with the D bar, except it now has an extra row. But anyway, now we follow the rules of Gaussian integrals. So this is the determinant of M. And therefore, we should say that this one is 1 over the determinant of M. Okay. So that's what we must mean by the beta gamma integral with one delta function inserted. I could go on for a long time, but because there are other things to talk about, I'm going to try to end this by just giving you one more example that's very illustrative. So we'll go back to the case of no zero modes, but we'll make one delta of beta and one delta of gamma insertion. So we have a delta of some integral of f beta and a delta of some integral of g gamma. Well, the principle which I could introduce the fermions again. Well, actually, let's introduce the fermions because it's illuminating. So now for the fermions, we'd also, let's actually eliminate the Beltramis and just take a point P and Q. So that's even closer to what people usually do if you use PCOs, which are delta function Beltramis. So the corresponding thing in the fermionic world would be delta of B of P, delta of C of Q, which is the same as B of P times C of Q. So you know what the answer is, therefore. The answer is the determinant of D bar times the propagator. S is the fermion propagator. On the other hand, we could have written this as a big Gaussian integral. So we'd call it, we'd add one new variable of ghost number 1 and one new variable of ghost number minus 1 to generate the delta functions. So we'd have db, dc, I need to think of letters I haven't used, du, dv. And then we have the exponential of b, b bar c.
So now there are no zero modes for b and c.
There are no zero modes of b and c, but we inserted 1b and 1c. So the path integral is a propagator. And after doing this, we'll see how to do it with the path integral for delta of beta times delta of gamma. And I will stop at that point. But you'll have the idea, hopefully. And you could do more complicated cases if you want. And if it isn't completely clear, you could look at section 10 of my paper, where it went into more detail than most people would want. So we won't have to go very far. All we have to know is that we could represent the delta functions by adding more variables to the Gaussians. So we'd have a u times c of q plus v times b of p. And then integrating over u and v would bring down b and c. But instead, not integrating over them just means we have a big Gaussian integral. So the answer is, therefore, the determinant of a matrix, which is d bar, but it also has an extra row and column now, which are sort of delta of q and delta of p, delta of z minus q and delta of z minus p. So we have two ways to represent it. It's the determinant of a matrix, but it's also simply an ordinary determinant times the propagator. Now, for beta and gamma, we again could represent the delta functions by integration over one more variable. It's the same thing as before. I won't even change the names, just because I don't think that would help too much. So you see, now we're doing a bosonic Gaussian integral with the same matrix as before. So if this was the determinant of a matrix, this has got to be 1 over the determinant of the matrix. But explicitly, the determinant of the matrix was the determinant of d bar times the propagator. So this is going to be 1 over the determinant of d bar times 1 over the propagator. So that's the path integral with the single delta of beta times delta of gamma insertion. So I did the case of 1 delta of beta, no delta of gammas, and 1 delta of beta and 1 delta of gamma. And if you're curious, you can either figure it out or else read what I wrote about it for more. There are innumerable interesting things here, but I think we probably need to stop.